The pianist and composer Franz Liszt writes these words of tribute. Chopin, gentle, harmonic genius. For those of us who held him close to our hearts, the mere mention of his name sends shivers all the way down to the bottom of our soul, as if we are recalling from our memory a higher being. Because of the pleasure his art has given us, all of his many friends lament his premature death. Liszt continues about Chopin and his artistry. Experience has taught us that when a prophet arrives and no one in his fatherland acknowledges him as such or does not see him as the visionary genius that he is it not true that in the future he is later recognized as a prophet of his time because of his progressive works? Honestly, could it be otherwise? And we dare to suggest that the artistic riches of every creative genius, every master, as well as the ideals, types, and forms that nourished and enchanted the spirit of his time, are deserted in order to invoke a new ideal and create new, unknown types and forms. The existing generation will be offended, and initially they will fight against the correct understanding of his imminent thoughts and feelings. Oftentimes in music, even more so than in other arts, only after some time will all the beauty, importance, and creative inspiration of the new forms be unveiled. Words of Franz Liszt about Frédéric Chopin in the collected writings of Franz Liszt, edited by Lina Rahman. Franz Liszt here celebrating Chopin, whom he knew as a friend, and the contribution Chopin made to the tradition with the development of new musical forms, suggesting that in the invention of such new forms, Chopin gave voice to emotions and feelings that had not had an appropriate expressive language up to that point. Liszt himself was not just a masterful performer, but a composer who made impressive contributions to the piano literature. Eugene Albulescu, performing here, writes that Liszt's late piano works bear some of his most avant-garde musical excursions. Here, an old man foreshadows the currents to come in the next three decades. Here, the visionary Liszt is revealed. That from notes from an all-Liszt recording by Eugene Albulescu that won the prestigious International Liszt Grand Prix du Disque in 1994. Eugene Albulescu is an award-winning performer and conductor who has been music director of the Lehigh University Philharmonic since 2007. He holds the Ronald J. Ulrich Endowed Chair in Orchestral Studies at Lehigh University, where he is an associate professor. And, as a pianist, Albulescu is a Steinway artist who is said to combine a blazing technique with the artistic integrity and originality to allow him to express musical emotions at their most personal level. He started his piano studies in Romania at the age of 6 at the UNESCO Music School in Bucharest. His family moved to New Zealand in 1984 to escape Romania's communist regime, and he eventually settled here in the States. Eugene Albulescu completed his musical studies at Indiana University, where at 19 he was the youngest person ever to reach the level of assistant instructor. He emerged on the international scene in 1994 when this, his debut CD, was awarded the International Grand Prix Liszt, adding his name to the list of winners, which includes Alfred Brendel, Claudio Arrau, Vladimir Horowitz, and George Bolet. Since then, Albulescu has performed worldwide, having been invited to the White House to play for the Millennium celebrations. He also performed at the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. This Sunday, October 30th, at 2 in the afternoon, Larcher Concert Group welcomes Eugene Albulescu for his first appearance in a three-concert solo piano series in Cohen Hall at East Stroudsburg University, during which he will perform music both by Liszt and by Chopin. We had a chance to speak by phone with Eugene Abulescu about this concert and his planning for the overall series.
I tried to put together a series of three programs that show in some way my take on the Romantic era for the piano. The roughly 70 years or so that we call Romanticism was quite eventful, both historically, politically, culturally. But when it comes to the piano itself, it was probably the most transformative. If you put side by side a piano from 1800 and a piano from 1880, they're almost unrecognizable in terms of the sound. So a lot of things changed, the nature of concert performances. So the beginning of the Romantic era in the 1830s, sort of the modern era of larger pianos, the new manufacturers such as Erard and Broadwood that had only been in business for a couple of decades. And so I thought, okay, well, out of this emerged, you know, the big pianists that were the big romantics. And so I thought I'd put together some programs that highlight, you know, both some of the historical ideas behind that, as well as composers that I perform a lot and that I really like. And so I have something to bring to the pot.
And in the course of your career, your performing life, your studying life, Eugene, how about access to these original pianos? Have you been able to play the Erards and the others? And what were the circumstances that gave you access?
Yes, here and there. The most notable is there's a historic instrument collection in Vienna. And then there's one in Graz, and I have been close to other colleagues who have their own collections. Pobo Duraskora is one of the most prominent collectors of antique pianos. But of course, today, many of those are really unplayable because of degradation, and it would be somehow doing them a disfavor to redo them because it kind of decreases the antique element, I guess the antique value. So most such pianos that are in use for early music instruction and recordings are really replicas. And they're very good quality replicas. So you could get very good replicas of an Erard or especially a Graf. And I've played, I think my alma mater, Indiana University, has a Graf replica. So it's kind of interesting because the action that we have today on most modern pianos it's an outcome of one particular type of action, but that was not all there was to it. So in other words, the orientation of the hammers on pianos are on the grand piano are what was called back then an English action. And most of these guys, Schumann, Brahms, composed for a Viennese action, which the hammers were back to front. And it was interesting to play on a Graf piano that has that type of orientation. The thing that changed everything was around the 1870s, late 1870s, Steinway introduced the overstrung action. And what that means, it's actually a pretty simple concept. Many of the strings go over other strings. So they crossed the strings, which meant that the bass strings go over the treble strings, and some of the treble strings go underneath the bass strings. And as a result of that, become much longer. And what also changed was the orientation of the grain, the wood grain in the sounding board. Because prior to that, a straight strung action, all the strings were parallel to the grain of the wood of the cedar, and the sounding board. And so that changed everything. And so what you're hearing when you're hearing a more historic instrument is the straight strung action, which does less to blur things, and things are slightly more transparent. And, of course, you know, we tend to think that, oh, well, that has to do with classical, but it's noteworthy to say that majority of works written in the Romantic era were written for a straight-strung piano, not for a cross-strung piano. It doesn't mean that it's bad on a cross-strung piano. Of course, it has so much more richness and everything. But, you know, the history of piano literature is really intertwined with the history of the piano, far more than people give it credit. So it is a very interesting thing to hear the same piece on two different pianos, because then you get the real feeling of like, wow, this is very different.
We know you have a critically acclaimed Liszt CD. it would go without saying that you've programmed Liszt.
Yes, so I'm playing the Sonata by Liszt, which I think is his most significant addition to the piano repertoire. Of course, he has such an array of contributions, but the Sonata was one of the big monumental pieces that he tried to do something new architecturally. It's like a one movement nonstop, but inside of there are these other tiny little movements. Every time I play it and I practice it, I realize how much I missed it, and I realize what an amazing masterpiece that piece is. And it's exciting for me to play it on the same program, which is in just a few days. I will be playing the second half of Chopin, an old Chopin. And I wanted to juxtapose these two great composers, both because they were the exponents of the new piano style. They were the Paganini of the piano era, so to speak. But also because they were very good friends. And Liszt was very influential in bringing Chopin to the public's recognition in Paris. And after Chopin died, Liszt was also very instrumental in keeping Chopin's name active and making sure that he gets the recognition as being a major composer, not just a pianist that happened to write some stuff. There's an interesting book that Liszt wrote in the aftermath of Chopin's death. That is, it's basically a book about Chopin. And so I thought it's kind of interesting to have these two composers back to back. So my first program starts with those two composers.
You've written intriguingly in the notes for your Liszt album on which you feature the Sonata. You give us a sense not only architecturally is the work intriguing, but Liszt, given his temperament, had things that were more than abstract going on in this Sonata.
Yes, well, there have been many cases made for a program to do with the Liszt Sonata. He was one of the strongest exponents of program music, which originated with people like Vivaldi in the Baroque era in his Four Seasons. I guess that must have been one of the first times that a piece of music was written that had, you know, words ahead of each piece and explain what each concerto signified. Well, here's winter, here's where you're going to hear the wind, and here's where you hear the birds, and etc. So Liszt, in many ways, was a continuation of one side of music that was very much very, very convinced of the music's power to convey a program in an incredible way. And there was a schism during the Romantic era between Liszt, and amazingly enough, even though that was an old idea, that was considered avant-garde at that time. So Liszt and a whole bunch of other people, like Wagner, were considered avant-garde for their day, the so-called New German School. And that created a schism between him and people like Brahms, who were very much into music being simply an absolute thing that signifies nothing but itself. And so as a result of that, lots of works of Liszt have pretty much a disclosed program, but others do not, and this is one of the pieces that do not have a disclosed program. And what a lot of people have done is they've looked at the types of themes that are in there, and they've found very close coincidences of the same exact theme or a very similar theme in some of his other works, and they have deduced that there has to be actually a religious implied program to it. And, you know, your listeners might not know that Liszt was actually a heavily religious guy. After having had a very promiscuous youth, I should say, he was kind of like an early iteration of Elvis in the 19th century. He did eventually get into religion and was actually going to become a priest. He was actually an abbé. So that religious aspect to his life, he was close to the papacy too. One of the works he wrote was The Fountains at Villa d'Este. Well, the Villa d'Este was one of the papal, it still is, I believe, summer residences. So it's a part of that, you know, people have looked at the themes and found out that, sure enough, there's possibly a thread that goes in here in the Sonata itself. And I should say that the only other sonata that he wrote actually does have a program. It's a fantasy quite like a sonata after a reading of Dante, which we call the Dante Sonata, therefore. But the B minor sonata, although it doesn't have a program, most people really do believe that it has something underneath there. And the themes themselves have to do with, you know, possibly Genesis and Christianity, fall, descent into the abyss, the fall of mankind, etc. It's It's not necessarily a proselytizing piece, but it's actually just a beautiful epic story that you kind of feel that aspect of it in music. And of course, it's fused with so much an incredible romantic fervor. So it's always a joy to play, I will tell you that. Not the easiest pieces either, but it's just wonderful, and I'm very happy to be playing it again.
What about the Chopin then? What kinds of pieces will you be bringing to us?
I chose kind of a smorgasbord of pieces by Chopin that I thought are some of his greatest contributions to music. Of course, Chopin wrote sonatas. There's two of them that are part of the overall repertoire for pianists. But by far, the most important pieces that he wrote were pieces that formed different series of different genres, some of which he coined. So I thought I'd include some of those, because prior to Chopin, people didn't write mazurkas as a piece of music. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. Prior to Chopin, people didn't write the scherzo as a standalone piece. It was just a movement of a sonata or a symphony, usually. Prior to Chopin, people didn't write a ballade. So he coined a lot of important words. He didn't coin the nocturne. John Field had started that, but he kind of brought it to a different level. So basically what I have done is I have one each of the pieces, the types of pieces that Chopin wrote that became important genres in themselves. So I have a polonaise. I'm doing the very well-known military polonaise. I'm having an A minor mazurka, one of his etudes, one of his scherzos, one of his ballades, and one of his waltzes. So that's basically the second half of the program.
We talked at the beginning, Eugene, about pianos and the development of pianos. What piano will you be using?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a 9-foot Steinway, and part of being a Steinway artist is that you get to play on a Steinway, and they do have a Steinway at the university, but it is not a full concert grand, so they're bringing a 9-foot piano, which I went and chose. I'm very grateful to Jacobs Music of Philadelphia, which is the Steinway dealer that we are dealing with here in the Valley. And so I went to Philadelphia and chose a piano, and they're going to bring it for each one of the concerts. That's very exciting. It's a great instrument, and I was able to choose very carefully an instrument that is going to be very well suited for the repertoire that I'm playing.
And how long does that take? Do you go in and you just know instantly, or do you go back and forth? And what's that like?
Yeah, often you try a few, yes. And in different places do it differently. This is a system that is national, and I remember a couple of years ago, maybe I did a concert in Boulder, Colorado, and I had to stop at the dealer in Denver, and they had like three pianos that I would choose from. Other places, if it's a smaller area, they will only have one, and you just have to play on that one. But the New York, Steinway New York, the Steinway Hall, whenever you choose from there, they usually have five set up for you, and so you can choose out of the five. Steinway New York has so many instruments. They cater to all the major touring companies, the halls, etc. And so they give you five, but if none of those are okay, you could go on a different day, and then they would set up another five. And so it's quite an exercise. But it's really interesting because, of course, they're incredibly babied, these instruments, and they're top-notch, but just like different violins, each one of them has, even though they are exactly identical and made to exact specifications, it never turns out the same exact way. You know, there's a lot of moving parts. I heard somewhere that there are more moving parts in a piano than there are in a car, something like 30,000 parts per se in the action itself. And, you know, the sounding board is different, and they age differently, a different part of the tree maybe that the wood came from. And so because of that, it will just sound different and it will feel different on the fingers. And you have to find, you know, the right match to the repertoire that you're playing.
Pianist and conductor Eugene Obelescu of Lehigh University speaking with us in anticipation of his first appearance in a 3-concert solo piano series at Cohen Hall at East Stroudsburg University hosted by Larche Concert Group, this Sunday, October 30th at 2 in the afternoon, on the program Music of Franz Liszt and Frédéric Chopin. For more information on the web, larchetconcertgroup.com, L-A-R-C-H-E-T concertgroup.com. That's Eugene Obelescu with Liszt and Chopin, Sunday, October 30th at 2 in the afternoon at Cohen Recital Hall at East Stroudsburg University. For more information on the web, larchetconcertgroup.com, larchetconcertgroup.com. As a footnote, there is a short video of Eugene Obelescu as he is selecting a piano at Steinway Hall in New York. And you can see it on YouTube, 3 minutes or so, but you can see him as he's making his decision. And that was a video that was prepared in 2010. The other two concerts to come, not just this Sunday, October 30th, but you can hear him as the series continues on March 19th and then again May 14th. A three-concert solo piano series featuring Eugene Obelescu, hosted by Larche Concert Group. The first of those concerts this Sunday, October 30th at 2 o'clock. Tickets are available at the door. And for more information, larcheconcertgroup.com, larcheconcertgroup.com.